Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. In the episode titled Deadly Daddy, I recounted the crimes of John Battaglia, a man so bent on revenge that he murdered his two daughters while their mother listened helplessly on the other end of the telephone. In this episode, you'll hear about two more deadly daddies who tried to cover up their crimes by placing the blame on someone else. Okay, on to the show. April 21st, 1992. Jesse Anderson and his wife of 7 years and mother to his three children, Barbara, walk out of a TGI Fridays restaurant in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. They had enjoyed the night alone, reconnecting. Jesse and Barbara had some troubled times in their marriage. This was an opportunity for Barbara to show her husband that she was serious about change. After three children, Barbara felt unattractive and felt her husband's eye wandering from their marriage. On the outside, Barbara and Jesse seemed like the perfect couple. They lived in a beautiful home in an affluent area of Wisconsin known as Cedarburg. Cedarburg is 20 miles or 32 kilometers away from Milwaukee. Their three children were adorable, well-mannered, and outgoing. Jesse met Barbara while he attended Elmhurst College in Elmhurst, Illinois. He graduated from Elmhurst in 1984, and on March 30, 1985, he and Barbara were married. Marrying Barbara was his second chance at love. Jesse married Deborah Ann Eckert in 1980. Their marriage was tumultuous and unhealthy. They welcomed a son in 1983, but despite hoping this child would change the course of their union, their relationship only worsened. In 1984, Jesse filed for divorce, citing severe mental cruelty from Deborah. I'm unsure if he was hoping this claim would encourage the judge to grant full custody of his son to him, but if it was, it didn't work. Deborah gained full custody of their son, and Jesse was forced to pay child support. He was not thrilled about this and gladly relinquished his parental rights when Deborah remarried. His marriage to Barbara was going to be better. It had to be. Jesse was an entrepreneur at heart, owning several landscaping businesses. He eventually settled on a position as a diesel fuel salesman. This job allowed him to live comfortably. They had three children, who will remain unnamed in this episode. When the family settled in Cedarburg, their neighbors found them to be quite the charming couple. Barbara immediately thrust herself into the community, volunteering to mentor young women as a big sister. They were active in their church, and Jesse was a member of the Lions Club. He was an aspiring politician. He lost a bid for the Cedarburg Board of Appeals in 1988, and in 1992, lost another bid for Ozaukee County Board. He was disappointed with each loss, and it further drove him to find more offices to run for. Barbara supported her husband with each endeavor he attempted. However, things were not as they appeared in the Anderson household. Jesse had been physically and mentally abusing Barbara for several years. She didn't confide in her family about the abuse going on, and there aren't many details on who she confided in, if anyone. That makes the events that took place on April 21, 1992, all the more strange and confusing. As the couple made their way to the vehicle, they were suddenly attacked by two young black men. Jesse remembers one of them wearing an LA Clippers baseball cap. He watched as the first man, holding a red-handed fishing knife, stab his wife in the face and neck. Barbara screamed in pain as she collapsed onto the parking lot. Jesse scrambled to protect his wife, but was stabbed in the chest and stomach. The first blow collapsed his lung. He screamed for help and people rushed to his aid. An onlooker exclaimed that Barbara had already lost consciousness. They were transported to the hospital and Jesse kept inquiring about Barbara's condition. Police arrived to get a statement from Jesse about the attack. He recounted the events of that evening. Doctors evaluated Jesse's wounds and found them to be superficial. Barbara sustained the brunt of the attack. When they asked him if he would like to visit his wife, he refused. The medical team noted that he remained rather emotionless and unconcerned about Barbara's worsening condition. The only time he seemed to show any emotion was when he was informed an autopsy would be performed on Barbara. On April 23, 1992, doctors informed Jesse that Barbara was not going to survive the injuries. She had been stabbed in the brain during the attack, and this ultimately caused her death. Jesse coldly informed them to just donate her organs, as he was discharged from the hospital. He returned to his home and was later visited by police to be questioned further. Police released details of the attack to the media and requested information on the two men Jesse said attacked them. Jesse noticed that the public was beginning to question his story. He sobbed uncontrollably whenever reporters would question his statements. How likely was it that two men had randomly attacked this couple? And why had Barbara been the only one to sustain life-ending injuries? Normally, an attacker would try to subdue the biggest threat first, but Jesse was only stabbed 4 times. Something wasn't adding up. Jesse must have been afraid that someone would notice him cracking. When the LA Clippers hat was revealed as a piece of evidence, someone noticed. That someone was Tommy Miles. He contacted the authorities and told them that he sold the hat to Jesse Anderson the afternoon of the attack. He asked police to check and see if there was a grease stain on the bill of the hat. If there was, then it was the hat he sold. Police confirmed that there was a grease stain. With this new information, they quickly diverted all of their attention back to Jesse Anderson. The fishing knife that was used in the crime was recognized by an employee of the PEX military store in Milwaukee. He contacted authorities and stated that he sold the knife to a man that resembled Jesse Anderson in March of 1992. He further elaborated that he only had 3 in stock, and the only one that sold was the one in March. He was certain that his store was the only store in the area that sold a knife of that kind. On Tuesday, April 28th, Jesse was charged with first-degree homicide. His vehicle was seized and searched. Upon searching, authorities found a skull fragment that belonged to Barbara in the vehicle. Pictures of his body were also taken as evidence, and those photographs revealed that Jesse had no defensive wounds on his hands. Barbara had been stabbed over 21 times, while Jesse had been stabbed only 4. The stabbing was seen as more emotional than a random stranger attack. He was held on a $1 million bail. The following Wednesday, May 6th, Jesse was formally arraigned on the charges. He entered a plea of not guilty. During his trial, it was revealed that Jesse had called Barbara's life insurance company to ensure her $250,000 policy was in effect. That gave prosecutors a motive that after years of silently abusing his wife, Jesse was ready to move on from Barbara. He didn't want to be responsible for paying child support for his 3 children, so he opted to eliminate Barbara from the equation. On August 3, 1992, a jury convicted him of murder. They only deliberated for 9 hours. Jesse's demeanor quickly changed from numbness to shock as the verdict was read. He held his head in his hands and shook. Barbara's family was elated with the news and congratulated each other and threw their fists in the air, cheering. The judge silenced them and set a date for sentencing, September 29, 1992. He was handed down a sentence of life in prison, with the possibility of parole after 60 years. A Chicago Tribune article cites the judge as saying, "I see a selfish, manipulative man who's concerned more with himself than his wife, children, and the community." He was to serve his sentence at the Columbia Correctional Institution in Portage, Wisconsin. If that prison sounds familiar, you might recall that notorious serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer was also housed there. On November 28, 1994, Christopher Scarver bludgeoned Jeffrey to death in a prison locker room bathroom. Jeffrey, Jesse, and Christopher were on janitorial detail that day. Christopher had taken a 20-inch steel bar from the gym equipment and hid it in his pant leg. He ambushed Dahmer and bludgeoned him to death, leaving him in a pool of his own blood. When he was done, he found Jesse and did the same thing. Christopher would later give multiple reasons for killing the pair, but for Jesse, he focused on the fact that he unjustly accused African-American men for his crimes. Jesse was transported to the University of Wisconsin Hospital, where he was taken off of life support. Christopher was found guilty of both murders and given additional life sentences. His comment on Jesse's death was profound to the community. Authorities were applauded for not targeting the African-American community when Jesse made his claims. Instead, they appealed to the public for assistance and were eventually set on Jesse as a person of interest. I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor. This is in stark contrast to our next murderer, Charles Stewart. Boston police, who had a long history of racism, bought Charles' story completely at the detriment to their case and to their relationship with the Black community. Generation Y covered the story of Charles Stewart's a few weeks ago, but we'd like for you to hear this story in comparison to the story of Jesse Anderson. On the night of October 23rd, 1989, Charles Stewart and his pregnant wife, Carol, left Lamaze class at Brigham and Women's Hospital near the Mission Hill neighborhood in Boston. Carol was 7 months pregnant with their first child, and she was excited to be a mother. A few minutes after they left the hospital, Charles called 911 from his car phone. Dispatcher Gary McLaughlin answered the call and heard a chilling sound, the wheezing breath of someone who was critically injured. Then a voice cried, "My wife's been shot. I've been shot." Gary tried his hardest to get Charles to tell him exactly where he was at, but Charles could not give him an exact location. He was, however, able to tell Gary what kind of car he was driving, which Gary relayed to the police officers looking for him. After a few minutes of trying to get Charles to tell him where he was at, Charles finally said they were on Tremont Street. First responders were finally able to locate them by using the sounds of the siren over the phone line. Gary would then direct cars by telling them if their sirens were getting louder or softer. 15 minutes after calling 911, a patrol car driven by Officer Wayne Rock finally found Charles and Carol. Seconds later, an ambulance pulled up. All first responders were shocked to see the heavily pregnant Carol slump forward in the passenger seat. Charles and Carol were immediately transported to the hospital they had just left, only a few blocks away. Carol's injuries were serious. A bullet had entered the left side of the back of her head and caused serious brain trauma. It was a wonder that she was still alive. Doctors tried to save her child by conducting an emergency C-section. The baby boy entered the world only weighing 3 pounds. A Catholic priest christened him Christopher Stewart, the name Carol and Charles had already picked out. Despite their best efforts, Christopher died 17 days later due to respiratory failure. Carol's injuries were too traumatic to overcome. At 3 a.m. on October 24th, she died without ever regaining consciousness. It is unclear if she died from her injuries or if she was removed from life support by her family. She was 30 years old. Charles's injuries were also very serious. He had one shot to his abdomen that had no exit wound. This means that the bullet ricocheted around his insides, causing a great degree of damage, and he was rushed into surgery. Surgeons found injuries to his liver, urological tract, stomach, and intestines. There was also damage to major blood vessels. Charles came very close to death, but survived his initial emergency surgery, as well as a second surgery. He would end up spending 5 weeks in the ICU and had to wear a colostomy bag, something he feared would happen. The paramedics that transported Charles to the hospital would later say that Charles never asked about his wife, but did ask if they thought he would have to wear a colostomy bag. When Charles got out of surgery, he told police his story. He claimed that shortly after leaving the hospital, a Black man with a gun forced his way into their vehicle and demanded they drive into Mission Hill. He then robbed the Stewarts of their cash and jewelry. After robbing them, he then shot Carol in the back of the head and Charles in the stomach. After shooting them, Charles claimed the assailant ran out of the car, and it was then that Charles called 911. Charles described the man as about 6 feet tall and 30 years old. He was wearing a black sweatsuit with red stripes, and he spoke with a raspy voice. Charles also claimed that the robber shot them after claiming that Charles was a 5-0, meaning he thought Charles was a cop. Charles was an ambitious man, something that could explain his later actions. His family says he attended Northeast Vocational High School and studied culinary arts. After he graduated, he worked as a cook in several small restaurants in Revere. It was at one of those restaurants that Charles met Carol. Along with working as a cook, Charles also worked as the manager of a fur shop. The couple married in 1985. Carol worked as a tax lawyer at a publishing company, while Charles managed the fur shop. The couple lived very well, pulling in over $100,000 a year. They lived in a nice neighborhood and bought a nice home. They looked like the picture-perfect couple. No one could have possibly suspected what Charles was capable of. Once police had a description, they ran with it. This crime struck a nerve with the community and was highly focused upon by the Boston media. Boston Mayor Raymond Flynn ordered, quote, every detective available to work on the case. It didn't go unnoticed by the black community that it was a white couple attacked in a predominantly black neighborhood that was garnering so much media and police attention. In order to try and find a suspect, Boston police amped up their stop and frisk technique, where they would stop and pat down any suspect that fit the description that Charles gave, which was a black man. This was already a controversial technique, as detractors stated that police overwhelmingly stopped and frisked people of color. To continue to use stop and frisk to justify the treatment the police gave to the members of Mission Hill, it created a lot of racial tension in a town that was already simmering with anger. The police's first suspect was Alan Swanson, a homeless man whose only crime was that he owned a black sweatsuit. Police kept Alan in custody for 3 weeks until they turned their attention to their new suspect, Willie Bennett. Willie Bennett fit Charles's description down to the raspy voice. He also had a history of violent crimes. Police also found a black sweatsuit that Willie owned, though it had white stripes instead of red. Police were also able to find some witnesses that claimed to have heard Willie brag about the crime. Though when the witnesses were brought in front of the grand jury, they recanted their statements. The nail in the coffin for Willie was when Charles had a, quote, violent reaction to seeing him in the lineup. Charles's behavior after the death of his wife rose suspicion for police that didn't buy his story about the robber. After leaving the hospital, he urged Carol's former employer to expedite the payout of her life insurance. Charles received $82,000. With that money, he bought a new Nissan Altima, worth $32,000 in cash. There were other life insurance policies for Carol, but police never revealed how many policies she had and how much they were worth. Police also found something else suspicious. After learning that Charles's telephone card was being used to make calls to him at the hospital, police tracked down 22-year-old Deborah Allen. Deborah was a graduate student at Babson and had worked at the fur store with Charles during the summer. Police thought there was a romantic link between the two, but determined Charles's feelings to be unrequited. Police believe that Charles bought a $250 14-karat gold brooch for Deborah, but she denied ever receiving it from him. Deborah was adamant that she was in love with her boyfriend and had no romantic ties to Charles. She said she called him to be kind, and Charles offered her his telephone card because she could not afford the daily phone calls. While Charles was playing it cool, someone knew the truth and could no longer take it. Matthew Stewart, Charles's younger brother, admitted to his older brother 3 days after the shooting that Charles's story was not the truth. After telling his brother, Matthew left town for a few weeks. In his absence, Boston was furiously searching for the black man who killed Carol and Christopher Stewart. When he heard about the charges against Willie Bennett, Matthew came back to Boston. Before going to the police, Matthew came clean to his family about his role in the shooting. After that, on January 2, 1990, Matthew went to the police to tell them his side of the story. On the night of October 23rd, Matthew and Charles prearranged to meet after the shooting. When he met Charles at his car, Charles handed him a .38 caliber revolver in Carol's bag. Matthew then, along with his friend John McMahon, drove to the river and dumped the gun and bag. Matthew stated he was under the impression that he was helping Charles with an insurance scheme and was promised $10,000 by Charles for his help. He claimed to have not seen Carol shot in the passenger side of the car. He also claimed to have not known that Charles was planning to kill Carol. After Matthew's confession, police had what they needed to arrest Charles. However, Charles learned about his brother's visit to the police, and he would not be taken alive. On January 4th, 2 days after Matthew's confession, Charles's new Nissan was found on the Tobin Bridge on the Mystic River. The car was empty, but a note was left on the front seat. The handwritten note used stationery from a nearby hotel where Stuart stayed the night before. The note stated, "To my friends and family, I love you very much. Thank you for standing beside me. My life has been nothing but a battle for the last 4 months. Whatever this new accusation is, it has beaten me. I've been sapped of all my strength. Chuck." There was no admission of guilt in the note. Police felt Charles would not have survived the 145-foot drop, and their beliefs were confirmed when they pulled Charles's body from the river. Charles Stuart was 29 years old. One of the more credible theories as to why Charles killed Carol was that he wanted her life insurance money to open his own restaurant. Charles had already demonstrated his ambition and desire to move up in the world. He may have thought that if Carol left her full-time job to become a full-time mother, it would throw a wrench into his plans. Friends also came forward with claims that Charles was resentful that Carol had the upper hand in the relationship after she became pregnant. Charles didn't like the fact that a child, even his child, could throw all of his plans into a tailspin. Police searched the Pines River and Revere where Matthew claimed to have dumped the gun. They found the gun, which corroborated Matthew's story. It was only after his suicide that Jay Kakis, co-owner of Kakis & Sons, the fur shop where Stuart worked, admitted that the store's .38 caliber revolver was missing. Had the two men come forward before, police would not have wasted time looking for the man Charles claimed committed the crime. On September 26, 1991, after 22 months of investigation, Matthew Stuart was indicted on charges of conspiracy to obstruct justice, compounding a felony, and unlawfully carrying a firearm. John McMahon, who was with Matthew the night he was disposing of evidence, was indicted as an accessory after the fact. He spent a few months in jail for his role in the crime. About a month after his indictment, Matthew pled guilty to taking part in an insurance scheme with his brother that resulted in the death of Carol Stuart. He was sentenced to 3 to 5 years in prison. He was released in 1995, but would return to prison soon after, on drug charges. Matthew would struggle with drugs until the end of his life. On September 3, 2011, Matthew Stuart's body was found in a Central Square homeless shelter. He died of a drug overdose, and it's unclear how long he had been in the shelter before he died. The city of Boston was deeply fractured after the Stuart drama played out. The black community was outraged that police fell for Charles' story and set back the investigation by several weeks following erroneous leads. But no one was more hurt than Willie Bennett. The Bennett family was visited by Mayor Flynn for a formal apology, but claimed he wouldn't sit down with them and was only in their home for a few minutes. Willie claimed to have lost his faith in law enforcement, a sentiment that was shared with much of the black community. It was surprising to me that despite committing similar crimes and targeting a community, that the response from law enforcement was drastically different. Sure, the authorities learned what not to do in Jesse's case, but why do you think it was so easy to target and shake down a whole community? Share your thoughts on this case and others in the Facebook discussion group. Just search for True Crime Fan Club. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and positively review the show on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request, send us an email, TCFCpod@gmail.com. Custom music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams. Check him out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Research assistance, content editing, and writing assistance for the show was provided by Brittany Martinez. Audio engineering was provided by Ches Gray, who manages Ches Gray Music.